It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, conservative firebrand Sarah Palin took to the stand last week in a libel lawsuit she brought against the New York Times. We'll hear more about the judge's decision just this afternoon in the case and what it could mean for journalism in the U.S. going forward. But first, a new survey by the National Education Association found that more than half of teachers, 55%, say they plan on leaving the profession earlier than they had originally planned. The number bears that out. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 43% of teacher jobs are now going unfilled. And for all the teachers leaving, there aren't enough new teachers to replace them. Teaching colleges are seeing declining enrollment. The pandemic has made problems that already existed in the profession worse. Low pay, stressful work. And we're talking about how the pandemic has affected the already stressful jobs of teachers today. And you can join in right now at 1-800-642-1234. Teachers, we want to hear from you. Has the pandemic made you reconsider your career advice? What have been the biggest challenges for you? Have you had to do extra work because colleagues have left? And what needs to change? What kind of support do you need going forward? Call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can always post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, and happy to take your emails at ideas@wpr.org. Tim Slecker is the Director of Education Preparation Programs at Muskingum University. He was the Dean of the School of Education at Edgewood College in Madison from 2013 to 2020. Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Lee. Thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate it.
It's good to have you back. I heard you talking to Rob, I don't know, 3 years ago on Central Time about this was not a teacher shortage. And here we are today with people saying this is a teacher shortage again. Tim, how do you see what's happening in the classroom with our educators?
Well, other than the COVID, the reality of what Rob and I talked about in 2019, again, the teacher shortage, whether we have one or not, again, I know it's semantics here, but one of the facts that I think listeners need to hear is that when I say there's no shortage, what I'm talking about is that what you said, the reality of the number of teachers leaving, the number of students who are not becoming teachers. So the pipeline into teacher education, the dips in enrollment teacher prep institutions are seeing. And maybe most important to hear this fact is that there are more licensed teachers in the United States than there are openings of teaching positions. So when I say there's no shortage, of people who are qualified and able to teach. We then need to ask the question, what is happening in today's classrooms? And in 2019, there was a lot going on. And since COVID, the reality of what's happening in the classroom, what is it like to be a teacher? The reality of what it's like to be a teacher is that the work has become unsustainable. It's not joyful. Teachers who went into the profession for the whole reason to make a difference, to be that one person who was in their lives, to help children, they can't realize that vocational aspiration. And so their agency and the research I've been doing over the 3 years with over 400 teachers, the reality comes down to something sometimes really simple, which I hope we can get into, is they just want to be allowed to teach again.
Well, that sounds strange to hear teachers saying they just want to be allowed to teach again. What are they doing instead?
Well, okay. So at this point, we could look at COVID. It could be a many things. And so now we'll use the word shortage, the number of people available to be involved in schools during COVID, whether it's school bus drivers, lunch personnel, custodial, and even the teachers, the reality is that the pitching in. And so I think the intro talked about teachers doing other things. Sometimes teachers right now are being called during their planning times, their other times, to either cover where they can't get personnel and or have 3 and 4 more classes put into the same classroom so that they can then supervise the students. So one of the things you're hearing is that we're doing a lot of supervision, not a lot of teaching with COVID right now. But the other part of this, what does it mean to say I just want to teach? This is the long-term problem that has just really intensified with COVID, is that for 30 plus years, we have been slowly telling teachers to account, to when I use that word, the accountability movement, No Child Left Behind, Race to the Top, Every Student Succeeds, there's been an imposition to take away agency, to take away professionalism from teachers and the realities and letting them make decisions about what's best for kids and putting in place rules where you have teachers who will say time and time again, if I follow this rule, this is not what's best for kids. If I do this, I'll be crossing a moral boundary. This is then, as they're saying in a lot of research, I'm demoralized. And when you hear about teachers saying, I need to leave, they were saying that in 2019. Throw everything COVID has thrown on top of teachers. And now why anybody is surprised to hear 50, 60% of teachers saying they're possibly thinking about not coming back as soon as next year. Nobody should be surprised by this. This has been out there. This has been happening now. The shortage, I said this before, is an exodus. The exodus is largely caused by the fact that we've had a large movement in the government, by think tanks, by everybody else to say, teachers, you can't do your job. We're going to mandate what it means for you to do your job. And taking away that professional agency and making teachers do things that they know are not in the best interest of kids, then of course the exit door is there and teachers are saying enough and they're out.
Tim Slecker is the director of educator preparation programs at Muskingum University. He was the dean of the School of Education at Edgewood College in Madison from 2013 to 2020. And we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. Teachers, parents, students, for that matter, what's happening in the classroom right now and what can we do to restore some balance, I guess? So what are teachers asking you about, Tim, in terms of what they need and how they're going to find it?
Yeah, that's, you know, I think that's a great question. The fact that we're asking and talking about it right now, I just had a piece published at Diane Ravitch's blog over the weekend, kind of reacquainting people to the teacher shortage based on some of the interviews I've been doing over the past 3 years. And, you know, what are teachers saying we could be or should be doing? You know, when I said the simplicity of just let me teach, the reality then of looking at what that means is restoring professional autonomy and agency and creating a sense of maybe let's talk about why are people not going into teaching? I think that's the one. And when you said students, I'd love for you guys, if they're out there, to call, because that's to me also one of the things that most people don't hear a lot about. I have at the time at Edgewood and now even here in my new position here in Ohio, I still meet with parents who talk about the fact that their child who's coming into investigate whether or not they want to be a teacher openly say they do not support their kid's decision to become a teacher. I've had more teachers say, I would never tell a student to become a teacher again. And I've actually had students in high schools come out and point up to me that, why would they ever want to take this position? They can actually see the demoralization in their teacher's eyes, the lack of respect. How do we then instill or reinstall respect to the profession? That's a great question. Part of the answer would be, first of all, recognizing the disrespect that is put out in front of teachers daily. It's recognizing and calling attention to the moment, Lee, when you're talking about what do? Before we do anything, the first thing we do is admit we have a real problem. We don't have a crisis of a shortage of teachers. We have a crisis of the profession. We have demoralized the profession. We have taken that choice away for someone who wants to inspire to help people be better, to be better humans, to teach and learn. We've taken away that desire. We now have to point out this moment and say something's going on. So the solutions will come when we're able to admit the real problem.
And Tim, I want to circle back to this in a moment, but first let's go to Joe in Platteville, who wants to talk to you. Joe, you're on Central Time. Good afternoon.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I missed a little bit of what your guest said. I agree with a lot of what he has said, but Act 10, to me, just put a dagger into the moral and the morale that teachers had in the classroom, it was to make teachers seem like they were kind of leeching off of society because of what happened in 2008 and the fact they still had a job and had all these benefits and everything else. It just made teachers seem like we were, you know, leeches on society, and that put on what I think your guest is talking about, people not wanting to go into the profession.
Yeah, Joe, do you feel that that legacy persists from Act 10 as you feel it?
Oh, yeah. I think it really hurt the morale. I was teaching at that time, and it hurt the morale in our district substantially.
Joe, I appreciate the call, and that goes, Tim, to the heart of what you're talking about, of the feeling that teachers are disrespected.
Yeah, think about, I mean, you know, Act 10, and when I was there, I had come right after Act 10 when I first got to Wisconsin and got there. And you know, that's an issue, and I know very personal to Wisconsin and Wisconsin teachers, and to hear Joe again remind us. But take all that in accumulation across the country, whether it's an Act 10, whether it's some form of taking away teacher autonomy, taking away teaching time. That's that weird thing we keep coming back to. Time allowed to teach, but not just allowed to teach, but to make curricular and instructional decisions that are best made at the local level within the classroom. Then throw in something like Act 10, which really was aimed at, as Joe pointed out, the fact that for some reason teachers had the nerve to have a job that paid them a wage and have benefits. And that was always, it was like, how is it that we turned that into the problem instead of the problem being people who don't have jobs with benefits? And so, as I said, this attack on teachers has come in multiple ways, whether it's coming at them from having a job with benefits or then coming at them from, quote, not doing their job, and we have kids who aren't learning, and therefore we need to blame them. And how we blame them is actually by taking away their professional expertise to teach, and we mandate curriculum, or as some people will say, we need a high-quality curriculum now to help teachers. No, we need to admit that we have taken the soul from teachers and stomped on it, crushed it, moved it around, and now we need to admit that we have to give back and restore and actually look at the teachers as the noble people that went into a profession, again, to help people become better humans. Recognizing that, and recognizing that what I just said too, it's a profession. It's a moral profession that people make a decision to actually give up wages, to give up benefits, to help others. And the fact that we're routing people from this profession, that should be frightening people all across the country.
That's Director of Educator Preparation Programs at Muskingum University, Tim Slecker. He is our guest, and we're asking you to join us at 1-800-642-1234. Teachers, parents, and students, how do you envision the future of teaching? How do you see its current state as it stands? We'll take your calls when we continue at 1-800-642-1234. That's next on Central Time. This is Central Time. On the Ideas Network, I'm Lee Rayburn, and right now we're picking up our talk with Tim Slecker, Director of Educator Preparation Programs at Muskingum University in Ohio. And we're talking about a new survey that found over half of teachers say they plan on leaving their profession sooner than they had originally planned. And we want to hear what you think about that at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Tim Slecker is the Director of Educator Preparation Programs at Muskingum University. And Tim, I want to ask you about UW-Madison School of Education, which has a teacher pledge program where teachers get financial support in return for working in Wisconsin's K through 12 schools for at least 3 years after graduation. You think this is a potential solution?
You know what? It's a move in the right direction that says that we have to do something different. My concern with any of these programs that are incentivizing people to become teachers is that if we're not looking at the conditions of what teachers are dealing with in the classrooms, what are the policies that situate and make up a teacher's day? What are the types of demands that we're putting on them when they get into the classroom? So, you know, supply side of this is one thing and to be thinking about. So incentives, of course, are great. But again, if we're only asking, you know, here a 3-year commitment, you know, the 3 years is not what's best for kids. It's better than teachers leaving in 1 and 2 years. I get that. But so besides incentivizing, we also have to have a direct approach that is looking at the culture of the classroom, the culture of schools, the culture of what it means to be a professional teacher day in and day out. Because I'm concerned that we will spend more money incentivizing more people into a profession, and we're going to see more people continue to leave. And people are going to then come back and say, well, we spent money on it. We tried to fix it. Obviously, spending money isn't the solution. And so that, again, I think the UW is on the right track there, incentivizing people. But we're not going to make any difference in teachers leaving, because that's the real problem. It really is the real problem. You'll have more people go into teaching when more teachers stop leaving, and those teachers typically, and when those teachers then come out and they're models for why people want to become a teacher. So incentivizing people to get into teaching, definitely we have to be doing that. But man, if we do not do anything that deals with the reality of what it means to be a teacher day in and day out, we should not be surprised that at the end of 3 years, anybody who's incentivized monetarily to get into it, we should not be surprised when we see them leave right when they're done.
1-800-642-1234 to join our guest, Tim Slecker, Director of Educator Preparation Programs at Muskingum University, where Michael in Mequon is standing by. Michael, good afternoon. You're on Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What do you think?
Well, I think when I'm in a classroom and I ask students what they want to do after high school, one of the things that I don't really hear too much of is, and this was touched on earlier, is, you know, I don't really want to be a teacher. And I think we have a lot of excellent students that could fulfill that, you know, that duty to society, and something that bears a lot of responsibility for how our society functions and what they can do. And I think it's, as it was said, it's troublesome that, you know, students already see that is a path that they probably don't want to take on. And I think we really need to show in a number of ways how we value that if we really want to continue to be, you know, the great society of people that we are right now, if we'd like to be that.
So you're a teacher, Michael?
I am, yes.
Are you one of those who is considering leaving earlier than originally planned?
You know, I think it crosses everybody's mind. I think there are a number of things that draw me to it still. I think when I got into teaching, I came into it with a love for teaching the subjects that I have, and loving to see the change that I could make when I was tutoring in college and helping out with middle school camps and helping younger students learn. And I think that still draws me, but there is a line that gets towed nearer, and it's tough to continue to look at teaching as this thing that, you know, I can do forever when there's all these challenges that we've been talking about.
If there was one thing that we could do for teachers in Wisconsin, Michael, from your perspective, what would that one thing be?
I like the conversation about autonomy. And giving teachers a platform to really show how they love to teach and to give them that autonomy to embrace their subject matter in a way that maybe they don't feel they're able to dive into tougher topics and have discussions with their kids about why what they're learning matters and how it can be applicable to them in the future, and to show them why teaching is so important to us.
Michael, thank you so much for the call. Tim Slecker, you heard from a teacher there, and autonomy seems to be, at least with the prevailing political debates about education, the other direction compared to where we're going, with calls now for cameras in the classroom and concerns over parents involved in the curriculum. It seems to be a stark contrast.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, you got to appreciate though what Michael just said though. Again, you know, what is it? What would make a difference? That autonomy, that sense of a lot of giving them back the classroom. And yeah, at the exact same moment that we're hearing a solution to the teacher exodus would be professionalism, allowing them to teach, you actually see legislation coming out telling teachers what they can't teach. Telling professionals who are history teachers that you can't teach facts if they make children uncomfortable. These are the types of challenges that I said, when you create a toxicity around the profession of teaching, people should not be surprised that we don't have students who want to go into it. And that is a huge fear. So when Michael says, I'm concerned about, kids in front of him that don't want to be teachers, we should be really concerned. The fact is that children themselves are already downloading that teaching is not a place to make a difference in the lives of others. And if people...
But it is, though, Tim, right? I mean, you and I both know that.
And that, you know what? Yeah, thanks, Lee, for bringing me back off of my cliff. Because the reality is that... But this is the importance, because these are the people that make a difference in all of our lives. These are the people that create the doctors, the engineers, the lawyers, the farmers, everybody else. And so when you take down our profession, the teaching profession, please recognize the harm that you're actually causing to society in general, and maybe even in your local community. And so that's when I ask people, would you really want some of the things that you see happening nationally, happening locally at your school? If the answer is, oh my goodness, no, we love our teachers, they do a great job, well, then it's time to get out and start telling them that and reversing the policies that have stripped away that professional agency so they can advocate and teach to the best of their ability for what's best for kids.
Tim, we're out of time, but I thank you for yours.
Thank you very much, Lee.
Tim Slecker, Director of Educator Preparation Programs at Muskingum University. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to an expert in First Amendment law about Sarah Palin's libel lawsuit against the New York Times and the judge's decision to throw the case out just this afternoon. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin native shares some of her latest poetry, including works inspired by the pandemic and the natural world. But first, it's the first libel case against the New York Times to go to trial in nearly two decades, and it was just thrown out by the judge this afternoon before the jury could reach a verdict. Brought by Sarah Palin, the former Republican governor of Alaska and 2008 vice presidential candidate, she said the New York Times defamed her in an editorial where they incorrectly linked her and her super PAC with a mass shooting in Arizona. Now, will the appeals process pave the way to a Supreme Court that has signaled that they may be inclined to revisit libel laws in the United States? And what's next, then, for Sarah Palin versus the New York Times? Journalists are watching because it may portend what's next for them. We want to know what you think about this case at 1-800-642-1234, whether or not you've been following it, what you think about the judge's decision to throw out the case before the jury had a chance to weigh in. Are libel laws in the U.S. good the way they are, or do they need some updates? What do you think? 1-800-642-1234. Always email us, ideas@WPR.org. Enrique Armijo is a professor of law at the Elon University School of Law in North Carolina, an expert on First Amendment and media law. Enrique, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be with you, Lee.
So a lot of news on this story today, but to start, and can you just lay out what is at issue in this case and what may be at stake ultimately?
Sure. And you laid it out well in your intro, Lee. Basically, what happened was that the New York Times published an editorial in 2017 after the congressional shooting at the Ellipse in Washington. And it was really about denouncing demonization of political opponents on both sides of the aisle. And as you also said in the intro, in that article, the initial draft of that article didn't reference Sarah Palin's PAC at all, but in a revision of that article, the editorial page editor, whose name was James Bennett, added this connection between the Gabby Gifford shooting, which took place in 2011, and a poster that Sarah Palin's PAC put out that had gunshot sites on certain congressional districts, including Congresswoman Giffords. And then James Bennett, the line that he added, said that there was no sign of incitement in the 2017 example as there was in 2011. Pretty soon after this comes out, almost immediately, the New York Times goes through this kind of internal debate and discussion about whether it was right, the reference that the Sarah Palin PAC poster had incited the Gabby Gifford shooting, whether or not that was accurate. And basically, about 14 hours after the editorial initially runs on the New York Times website, that line is taken out. So really what Sarah Palin sought to do is say that the New York Times should be liable for a mistake. The mistake here being, as I said, claiming a connection between the poster and the Gifford shooting. And what Judge Rakoff said really just about an hour ago was that a mistake wasn't enough, that under the First Amendment, what Governor Palin had to show was what's known as actual malice, which is a technical term in defamation law. It comes from a case in 1964 called New York Times versus Sullivan that says that when the person bringing a defamation claim, when the plaintiff is a public official or public figure, they have to show that the defamatory statement was made with knowledge of its falsity or with reckless disregard as to whether or not it was true. And what Judge Rakoff basically said this afternoon was that Governor Palin had put forth no evidence that that Mr. Bennett knew that what he said about her was false, that this was just a mistake. Mr. Bennett even said on the stand that he regretted making the mistake, but that wasn't enough under the First Amendment for the New York Times to be liable for defamation.
Enrique Armijo, our guest, professor of law at the Elon University School of Law in North Carolina. And so while the judge threw out Sarah Palin's case against the New York Times earlier today, jury deliberations are continuing despite the judge's ruling. Enrique, why is this?
Well, it's certainly odd for Judge Rakoff to have basically announced his decision, his judgment. The technical term here is judgment notwithstanding the verdict. So what that means is that the New York Times is going to win regardless of what the jury says. But what Judge Rakoff said in open court today was that he is certain that that Governor Palin is going to appeal. As you also said in your intro, there's this kind of climate around the actual malice standard that is open for debate. As you also said in the open, the Supreme Court, or at least two members of the Supreme Court, seem open to it. So what he wants to do is give the appellate courts the benefit of the jury's findings of fact with respect to what the New York Times did and didn't do. So for that reason, he basically is permitting the jury to continue to deliberate. And really, you know, it's a little bit ironic at this point that the only people who don't know that Judge Rakoff is going to throw out this case are those jurors that are deliberating right now.
Oh, wow. So, and the two justices on the Supreme Court that are Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch, but also through some tough media firestorms, the appointments of Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. What would your take be if this were appealed all the way to the Supreme Court, and how the current makeup of the Supreme Court may come down on this issue of libel in 2022?
Well, it's certainly true that if for Governor Palin to win, the Supreme Court is going to have to change the law. And it's the only court in the federal system that can do that, right? The lower courts are constrained by Supreme Court precedent and other precedent to follow the law. You know, Judge Rakoff even kind of made some statements this afternoon that, you know, it pains me to hold this way, but the law is forcing me to hold this way. And if I were the New York Times, I would be a little bit worried. You know, it takes four justices to hear a case. As you already said, we have two that we know what they think, that they want to reconsider this. And then we have another two, as you also said, that haven't really spoken on this issue. But there is a lot of momentum towards kind of revisiting this idea that it should be really hard for public people to sue for defamation. And Judge Gorsuch, in his recent opinion on this, talks about the fact that, and you can, you know, you can take him for, you can agree with him or not, but what he says is that the media is very different than it was in 1964. it would be kind of ironic to overturn New York Times versus Sullivan in a case that also involves the New York Times. but that, you know, because as I said, you know, what Gorsuch talks about a lot in his, you know, in his opinion is the idea that the media is not the institutional media. There's a lot more fact checking. The internet has caused defamation plaintiffs to be false and loose with the truth. There's a lot more defamation out there. But, you know, the New York Times is going to have to be prepared to defend not just the result in this case, but also the rule in Sullivan that makes it harder for them and other media outlets to be sued for defamation.
Enrique Armijo, I am a journalist in a world that has changed our libel laws as we see them as a result of this case in the not so distant future. If our libel laws were to change as a result of this case, ultimately based on appeal and potentially going all the way to the Supreme Court, what changes for journalists?
Well, it's important to point out that when we talk about the media, and I get the Gorsuch did mention this in his recent opinion, we're not just talking about the New York Times. You know, Fox News and One America News and Newsmax are all being sued. Your listeners might know, by Dominion Voting Systems for some statements that were made on those television stations by guests and hosts with respect to some false statements about Dominion and its involvement in some false allegations about its involvement in rigging the election. In all of those cases, all of those media outlets are relying on the actual malice standard. So in other words, Fox News is saying, we have to be able to report on the fact that that the president of the United States is claiming that the election was rigged. And that involves reporting what the president and others are saying about Dominion voting systems. If we're only reporting, we're not reporting with actual malice. So what the defenders of the actual malice standard have said and are going to say is that in the absence of this extra protection, we're going to be less likely to do things like write about editorials of the kind the New York Times wrote. We're going to be less likely to report on public figures and public officials. And the net result of that is less commentary. And that's really what the First Amendment is intended to protect and promote.
Our guest, Enrique Armijo, professor of law at Elon University in North Carolina. He stays with us for a closer look at the former Alaskan Governor Sarah Palin's libel lawsuit against the New York Times, a case thrown out by a judge this afternoon, but that may continue on appeal, and the jury continues to deliberate in that case. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. What do you think about libel laws as they stand now in the U.S.? Do they need to be changed, scaled back? Would you like to see stronger protections for journalists? What questions do you have for our guest about how libel laws work and your First Amendment rights? 1-800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn and for Rob Ferret today, and we're picking up on our look at libel laws in the U.S. and what's at stake in a libel lawsuit against the New York Times that was thrown out by a judge today, but may certainly continue on appeal. We want to hear from you, your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234. Our guest this afternoon is Enrique Armijo. He's a professor of law at the Elon University School of Law. And Enrique, I'm curious what your takeaway was from some of the testimony in this case, the testimony of Sarah Palin in the New York Times in the first libel case of the New York Times to go to court in about 20 years. Promised to open up and expose the process of newsmaking and editorializing inside the New York Times. What did we learn?
Yeah, I think if those who are following the trial closely might have found that, you know, the process of writing an editorial at the old gray lady, the great New York Times, is a lot messier than they might have thought. You had the editorial page editor, right? The person who was in charge of the editorials at the Times, writing a time-sensitive, on-deadline column, or supervising the writing of a column, and putting things in the column, putting facts in the column that were not entirely supported either by his own research or by things that the newspaper itself had reported. And, you know, as I said earlier, you know, Mr. Bennett got on the stand and said that this was a mistake and this was my fault. But the strategy of the New York Times lawyers, and the successful strategy, as we saw today, was that the mistake is not enough. The Palin strategy here was to kind of show that the New York Times was biased against her, that this was part of the kind of the liberal media versus the conservative heartland. that they looked down on her, that they thought less of her, that they thought she was a gun nut, and that that was enough to kind of supply this mental state that the standard of actual malice requires. But at the end of the day, they didn't really have any facts. They didn't develop any facts that tended to show, again, that Mr. Bennett knew that what he was writing was false. At most, he didn't know it was true. He kind of let his rhetorical flourishes get the best of him. He quickly regretted that. You know, there are text messages and email messages late that night and early in the morning, Mr. Bennett communicating with the reporter, Elizabeth Williamson, who wrote the column, communicating with Ross Douthat, who's this very prominent conservative editorial page writer at the New York Times, that basically said to Mr. Bennett in an email, I don't think what you said is right. And then you had this kind of scramble on the part of Mr. Bennett trying to write this wrong, which he admitted was wrong, but he didn't write this knowing that it was false. And for purposes of actual malice, that's what Sarah Palin needed to show by clear and convincing evidence. And as we've said, Judge Rakoff said she wasn't able to do that.
And the Supreme, or at least two members of the Supreme Court, have at least suggested that they'd be willing to revisit that. So what happens to this case next, Enrique?
Well, Governor Palin, as Judge Rakoff said in court today, she is going to appeal to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which is also in New York City. That's the kind of federal court of appeal that hears trial court, hears appeals of trial court decisions in the Southern District of New York. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals is going to side with Judge Rakoff. You know, based on the current law, okay. I don't think there's really anything that they're going to be able to help Governor Palin here. And then, as we said earlier, what Governor Palin is going to try to do is appeal to the Supreme Court for an actual change in the law.
And we'll see if they take that case up. Let's go quickly to Erica in Lake Tomahawk. While we're short on time, I want to get this question in. Erica, you're on with Enrique Armijo.
Hello.
Hi.
I would just like to kind of know, where is the line drawn with some clown like Tucker Carlson, or a clown like our ex-president, who seems to be able to say pretty much anything and call it entertainment? I mean, could could this editorial writer say, oh, I was just fooling around?
Eric, I appreciate the question because it goes to the heart of this case to some degree. I mean, where do you draw that line, Enrique?
Then that's actually some of the critiques about the actual malice standard I think are justified, because what they require, as the caller kind of implied, is the state of mind with respect to the person who made the statement. And, you know, the former president, whatever you think of him, certainly in his mind believed the things that he said were true. So, by his lights, you know, he's never made a false statement. If all you can go by, all you can look at to decide whether or not something is true or false is the subjective police of the subjective state of mind of the person saying it. So it does create real evidentiary problems for defamation plaintiffs to try to find through some other evidence whether or not someone actually thought what they were saying was true.
Yeah, in our last
so
60
it is a
seconds,
robust defense.
I'm curious, you know, as a professor of law and a specialist in the First Amendment rights, where could we, how could we begin to redefine what libel could mean outside of the actual malice standard?
I think the way if libel law is going to change, I think we need to look more at the damages side. You know, I think there are good arguments you could make that this case was never really brought, but the never should have been brought. The reason it never should have been brought is because Sarah Palin never was able to make any definitive statement with respect to any opportunity she lost or any monetary damages that she had as a result of this case. So one thing we could do is make defamation plaintiffs have very strong evidence of actual damages that they've suffered as a result of defamatory statement, and that might narrow the potential liability of the media to those cases in which their false statements have really caused defamatory harm.
And one of the evidences that was brought in by the defense for the New York Times was Sarah Palin's appearance on The Masked Singer on Fox after the editorial came out.
Yeah, and it is interesting, you know, she does seem to have had kind of a semi-retreat from public life, but I don't think anybody in the courtroom was persuaded that that was a result of what the New York Times had written
about
her in this editorial.
We're going to have to leave it there, but I appreciate your time this afternoon. Thank you.
Great, thanks.
Enrique Armijo teaches about media and First Amendment law at the Elon University School of Law in North Carolina, on with us to talk about the judge's decision earlier today to throw out Sarah Palin's libel lawsuit against the New York Times, and what could happen next if the case is appealed.
Now, political polarization of the pandemic hasn't spared Wisconsin school boards. Mass disputes and unruly crowds shut down meetings. Board members faced recalls, and some have resigned over threats. That's led to charged local primaries. Tomorrow, Madeline Fox has more.
Kathy Olig's first campaign to be a Menominee Falls school board member in 2019 feels simple now.
I purchased some yard signs. I talked to people about voting. I participated in the candidate forum. There was just one. And everything kind of went fairly smoothly.
But this year, there are 8 candidates for 3 open slots in Menominee Falls. So she's competing in our first primary.
I think that the schools have been put under scrutiny as a result of what's happening nationally.
That's true in a lot of communities, especially in the suburbs.
You know, as a former school board member, I ran 4 times. 2 I ran without any competition, and 2 I ran with a lot of competition. I think it ebbs and flows.
Terry Phillips is the executive director of the Southeast Wisconsin Schools Alliance. She says that while school board positions are nonpartisan, politics are playing a bigger role.
There are board members who are conservative Republicans who are being contested because they're not conservative enough, apparently. And so that's been so interesting to watch.
Part of that may have to do with national conservative groups looking to regain ground in increasingly competitive suburbs. Vladimir Kogan is a political science professor who studies state and local politics at Ohio State University.
Part of this is, I think, you know, a really rational and strategic effort by, I would say, primarily Republicans who see this opportunity, and probably rightly, right, that this, I do think this is a great opportunity for Republicans to win back suburbs that historically have been pretty red, but now are more and more blue.
Many primary candidates got involved over concerns about how their district was handling COVID-19. But they're getting a boost from national parties and political action committees, which can provide money, strategy, and help gathering signatures and getting the word out. Those were at play in the unusually large wave of recalls over the last 2 years. 17 districts saw recall attempts, including one against Butternut School Board member Gary Murdig in northern Wisconsin, who defeated a December challenge.
It kind of split the community a little bit, which is unfortunate because there are the pro-mask and anti-mask folks.
Murdig isn't up for election until next year, but Butternut will have school board primaries this year for other seats, which has been a rarity during his 31 years on the board.
I'm trying to think the last time we would have had a primary for school board is it's been a long time.
Murdig and others watching rural schools say board meetings are drawing fewer angry community members these days. But some wonder if debates over critical race theory will bring them back. Vladimir Kogan, the Ohio State political scientist, said school board clashes over national hot-button issues aren't new. Sex education, the Common Core, evolution, and voucher programs all cause similar uproar.
You know, there's always national conversations about education. But those are, in the past, were counterbalanced by local conversations about local issues. And I think that counterbalancing is going away.
There are fewer local newspapers to send reporters to school board meetings, so many communities don't know enough about local issues to take the focus off national debates. But Murdig says most school board business is local or deals with thorny regulatory questions, which can be frustrating for politicized candidates that win elections.
Once in a while, we'll have an issue that would have come up over the years, and sometimes it spurs interest in certain people running for the board, and they become a one-issue candidate. And then as soon as they get on the board, they kind of lose interest.
After the primaries narrow the field in some districts, all the school board races will go to general election on April 5th. Madeline Fox, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hey, coming up tomorrow morning on The Morning Show, what do you know about the Wisconsin Supplier Diversity Program? Kate Archer Kent talks with the president and CEO of a Wisconsin company about the state's purchasing power and the value of prioritizing diversity. That's tomorrow morning right here on the Ideas Network. And then join us for Central Time tomorrow afternoon as we take you to the most fun you can have below freezing. I don't know where that is yet, but we're going to find it for you before we get to tomorrow. Also tomorrow, the latest on the hunting of gray wolves. They're back on the endangered species list, at least for now. And we'll find out what that might mean for future wolf hunts in Wisconsin. Also tomorrow on Central Time, no-knock warrants. after a 22-year-old black man was shot and killed by a Minneapolis SWAT team during the execution of a no-knock warrant last week. We're going to be taking an in-depth look at how they're being used in Wisconsin. That's tomorrow, starting at 3, right here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. And if that's not enough, join us tomorrow night. WPR brings you, starting at 7 o'clock, live coverage of the 2022 State of the State Address by Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers. It'll be followed by a Republican response from State Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemieux, and it'll be hosted by WPR's own Sean Johnson, along with PBS Wisconsin's Frederica Freiberg. That is the 2022 State of the Union Address by Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers, and it's tomorrow night at 7, right here on WPR. The mascot cannot speak. That is the official word of the Beijing Olympic Organizing Committee to the Wall Street Journal. The mascot in question is Bing Duan Duan, the ice-coated, smiley-faced, rather portly panda representing the 2022 Winter Olympics. One of the standout stars so far of these Olympics, Bing Duan Duan gave an exclusive interview to China's state-run TV last week, and for the first time, fans were able to hear from this hugely popular childlike panda. It turns out Bing Duan Duan sounds just like an old blue-collar working-class guy, and the national cognitive dissonance was instant and overwhelming. Within hours, China's censors went to work trying to eliminate any evidence of the panda's voice, gender, and implied socioeconomic status. Chinese media claimed the talking Bing Duan Duan was an imposter. The Beijing Olympic Organizing Committee insisted the panda only emits babbling noises. Quote, the mascot cannot speak, end quote. If only they could, what might they say? You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.